Hello, and welcome back to Season 11 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage nearly $150 billion in assets, and that capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. This week, we're going to dive into current credit market trends that we're seeing. Joining me today is Vikas Keswani, head of North American Specialty Direct Lending here at HPS, and Scott Crocombe, a managing director on the HPS Liquid Credit team. Thank you both for joining us. I'm going to start with you, Scott. Let's start with the Fed. You know, we've got forecasts now that call for 6 Fed rate cuts between now and the end of next year. Do you agree with those estimates? And I'm curious your reaction as to where you think that curve goes.
Sure. So I'd say this. I think 6 rate cuts projected is a lot more realistic than the 7 to 8 that we were seeing prior to the jobs number 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I'd say we are closer to that as far as our estimates go, because that 7 to 8 cuts would have put us inside of 3% in terms of, you know, long-term outlook for short-term rates. First of all, I don't think that's very realistic for a fundamental reason, which I'll get to. The second is we're not exactly sure the economy is going to need that much help. So we've, you know, taken the view that we probably wouldn't have that aggressive of a cutting cycle. And the other one was, and this goes back to really the beginning of the year, late 2023 as well, a lot of our underwriting is focused on inflation, not surprisingly, specifically, you know, the inflation that matters to us, which is labor inflation. We really weren't seeing it abate, and we had a hard time getting our arms around the fact that the Fed was going to start cutting early in the year. That's really rolled through to now. Plus, we got the kind of front-loaded 50 basis point cut in September. So we think we're at a place where you'll probably get, you know, the 225 basis point cuts through the end of the year, just because the Fed probably doesn't want a market surprise, and I think that'd be viewed pretty negatively. After that, it wouldn't surprise us to see a bit of a pause and kind of a reevaluation and maybe live somewhere inside of that aggregate 6-cut number. But generally speaking, if we get to the place where the Fed, you know, gets short-term rates to 3, 3.25, and we're still cutting on top of that, I think we're in a worse place than spreads and equities are implying right now. And we've generally been a little bit more constructive than that.
So, Scott, if you go down that path, you know, regardless of the slope of the curve, you know, you're going to continue to see rate cuts over the next 12 to 18 months. What's the impact of that on your public credit business, and what should we expect with spread movements in response?
Many of our portfolios have the ability to kind of freely move between loans and bonds, and therefore fixed versus floating rate exposure. Much like the rest of HPS, we do full fundamental underwriting. We make every investment based upon the credit. But we obviously try to pick up excess return, you know, based upon where the convexity would live or the optionality in a certain investment based upon a general rate view. As I said, we've had the view of higher for longer for, you know, for some time now. That has kept us overweight loans. There was a minute there in the summer where it looked like, you know, bonds were going to sprint past loans in terms of performance. We've seen that reverse out in October. In October alone, there's almost 100 basis point differential in loan versus bond performance, which is really that kind of resetting of people's rate expectations, right? And the two indices are pretty much right on top of each other in the kind of mid 7% returns for the year. For us, that means, you know, we still favor loans. There's a great pickup in yield and specifically current yield that you're going to have to burn off with this kind of move down in the base rates. We're fine to keep that exposure for now and earn that excess return. Bonds, we're waiting for a little bit more convexity. So, you know, we'd like to see maybe some supply push spreads wider and get, you know, the type of opportunities that can really drive performance through dollar price appreciation. We really just haven't seen that in the bond market much. So still favoring loans, waiting a bit in bonds.
So Vikas, same question to you. It's been 15 years since we've seen a rate cut environment. Private credit was a very small asset class back then. Talk to us about the playbook now for your side of the house. What should we expect from that rate and therefore spread moves, and how you think about how the impact that is for allocating the portfolio?
Sure. I'd sort of start with this observation, which is the vast majority of private credit is floating rate. And the vast majority of borrowers have been utilizing these floating rate loans without any hedging. And that has been interesting to watch. As you saw rates increase, that created a tremendous amount of stress for these borrowers. As we're starting to see that turn, you're starting to see that alleviate quite dramatically. As fundamental underwriting-focused investors, we are measuring free cash flow, levered free cash flows. What is available from a company's perspective to repay the debt that they are incurring? And what we do expect is that will get increasingly better for the portfolio. New opportunities will obviously be underwritten with this rate dynamic in mind. But I think where you see the real windfall is in the portfolio itself.
Fair enough. Scott, back to you. We've seen meaningful spread tightening across public credit this year. Do you think at this point investors are being fairly compensated for the risks of the market?
Through the lens of both loans and bonds, it's a bit of a different answer here. The bond market is extremely tight from a spread perspective. I'm not making these numbers up. Bond spreads, ex-triple Cs for now, but bond spreads are anywhere between the 0th and 5th percentile in terms of relevant historical norms. Obviously, that implies that we're at or near the tights for a lot of these assets. And so it's led us to be very cautious of bond risk in general, specifically anything with real spread duration to it. So the short answer is not really in bonds, and we're being very cautious, staying short dated. And there are some, ironically, opportunities in very low coupon paper, because just with the way the math works, it's still trading below par as they approach their maturity dates. Because not surprisingly, companies have waited and waited and waited to refinance this paper because it's been such a favorable coupon for them. So dollar discounted high quality paper where you can maybe be right on an earlier takeout versus an at maturity takeout, that's accretive to your IRR. And we don't think you're introducing much default risk or really mark to market risk into the portfolio. So we don't mind that from a spread risk perspective in bonds. Otherwise, you know, you have to move out towards triple Cs to get any real spread juice into a bond portfolio. We don't think that's a mispricing we necessarily want to take advantage of. Loans are a little bit different. I mean, you're at 475 spread-wise on the loan index. That's about the 25th percentile, just to make it an apples-to-apples metric with what I was saying about the bonds. That's not terrible when you look at it through the context of yield, because you're in about the 70th percentile in terms of historical yields for the same metric, right? Because your base rate is so high. And like I just said, we have the view that that rate might get pushed out longer. And we like that option more than the option on tightening of rates from here in the bond market. So that's where we're focused most of our spread bets. I will say, just to give you a data point on triple Cs for loans too, double Bs versus triple C loans are 1,000 basis points apart in terms of spread. And I'm sure we're going to talk about dispersion at some point here, but that's a big factor in our market. And again, it's not a segment of the market we want to be playing in from a risk perspective. And so we've stayed away from that.
Because on the private credit side, private credit often gets painted with a very monolithic brush. And of course, that's not right. There's a bunch of different sort of lanes within it. We've seen greater spread tightening in sort of more flow private credit, you know, less spread tightening in the more complicated, nuanced stuff. Can you talk through a little bit about those dynamics and where you see the opportunities?
As you know, Colbert, our industry is primarily made up of folks that are lending to private equity firms. And when you drill down a little bit further, what you notice is people are really focused on LBOs, leveraged buyout lending. This is sort of your traditional situation in which a buyer is purchasing a business for, let's say, $100 and seeking $40 to $50 of financing. It tends to be quite competitive. Why? It's relatively easy to get into. You call up all of your friendly private equity firms and you say, hey, let us finance your deals. The underwriting, for the most part, is in the purview of that financial sponsor, of that private equity firm. They do a lot of good work and you can benefit from it. And so we do take the view that that market is the most competitive. There's also a little bit of a lack of M&A going on in that market, causing an even further tightness in spreads. But if you go beyond it and are willing to do the work, really not relying on that private equity firm, but relying on your own underwriting, your own capabilities, prosecuting due diligence yourself, you can start lending to companies outside of the LBO space, which would be, you know, private equity firms as well, but those seeking a refinancing or a tuck-in acquisition of some sort. Or further afield, non-sponsors or public companies, private companies, companies owned by sovereign wealth funds, other types of institutional investors. We've seen less spread tightening there and less competitive tension there generally.
Yeah, it makes sense. Scott, I want to pick up on a thread you left off on there around dispersion. You know, that's been a real theme in the credit markets the last couple of years. Do you expect that to continue, or do you think you're going to see more performance compression going forward?
So just on what we've seen so far, because I think it is informative to where we're going, we've seen dispersion get a lot worse in the same time period that we've seen the credit markets and spreads get a lot better, meaning tighter markets, more dispersion. Obviously, that means it's taken to an utmost extreme in terms of this metric that we're focused on here. And one of the big reasons for that, and Colbert, you deal a lot in situations like this, I know, is that downgrade risk and certainly the need to raise liquidity has really been punished in this market environment. We actually think for good reason, because a lot of times now, default risk or even the potential for default has become much more of a foregone conclusion because the market is so I won't say over-manipulated, but manipulated by folks who want to intervene proactively, be that the advisor community who's obviously pursuing transactions, lenders, private lenders who are seeking to, you know, do creative deals and interesting financings to help companies alleviate defaults. But as we know, with documentation, liability management these days, that can take on a form that is actually to the detriment of the existing lenders in a capital structure, even though it does avoid a potential default. So again, we've really focused our research team on trying to underwrite to not only performing scenarios in, say, a base and a stress case, but also to avoiding downgrade risk and the need for incremental liquidity in both of those cases as well. So actually, I don't think dispersion is really going to abate very much. I think it's kind of here to stay, and we've hit a bit of a new paradigm in terms of what it means for our market.
I'm going to come back to you, Vikas. You know, we've been in a, you know, higher rate environment now for, you know, 18 months or so. The reason for that, obviously, was we saw inflation. Inflation, as Scott said, has remained endemic. How's the portfolio holding up against that environment? Higher costs, higher borrowing costs, like how's it doing generally?
Surprisingly well. I mean, if you look at the few years since COVID, we've had one-off events to talk about. We can talk about freight increasing quite dramatically, given various port closures, shipment volumes, Red Sea issues, so on and so forth. We've seen inflation, as we've already talked a lot about, but particularly in commodities, very specifically crude as well as raw materials. And then we've seen wage inflation, and that will hit very specific sectors, be it healthcare, retail, consumer-oriented sectors, that sort of thing. Each of those issues, though, have been relatively sporadic in terms of intensity.
Yeah,
and
sort of episodic. There's having
episodic.
One-off. That's exactly right.
Better word. I do think, and I wanted to connect the comment to what Scott was talking about around dispersion. I do think in private credit, dispersion is going to come from ultimate losses and how one manages through stress.
Scott, same question for you. How's the portfolio holding up against this rate and inflationary environment?
There's a lot of pitfalls in this market, and it's more about what you don't do than what you accomplish, if you will, from your underwriting. So what you avoid and what you're able to move out of is equally, if not more important than kind of the wins you have, especially when what we're trying to capture are historically attractive yields plus some upside there. That's what we're underwriting to. And so we have, I think, experienced some stress early on in the portfolio. Vikas hit on a few of them, you know, physician-oriented and patient-oriented healthcare, where there's a big skilled labor component. We've seen margins pretty much evaporate, you know, certainly at a given point in time in that industry. Anything tied to logistics or some sort of cyclical swing that would require an inventory destocking, these are things that we thankfully front-loaded a lot of work on, identified some issues and moved on from a few situations. So that's been a big part of our strategy in terms of how to keep the level of performance within the portfolio.
Vikas, you mentioned M&A volumes, and obviously we saw a real chilling effect in M&A post the rates move. If you look at the private credit side of the house, you know, historically we do about 2/3 M&A related, about 1/3 refi. That's inverted for the last, you know, year or so. Do you see signs of M&A volumes picking back up? And if so, what do you think drives that resumption of M&A activity?
I'm going to make a little bit of a nuanced point here, which is you're right to say M&A volumes in terms of actual transactions is depressed, 70%+ in sort of the market we would be ordinarily targeting. However, I do think M&A activity has been quite elevated. And what I mean by that is, if you talk to investment bankers and owners of assets and buyers of assets, assets have been marketed quite heavily, in fact. They're just not transacting. And there's this significant, maybe compressing, disconnect between buyer and seller on price, on valuation. So it's not for lack of effort or lack of trying that you haven't seen M&A volumes. If I were to guess, and I'm speculating here, I would say there's probably a 15%, maybe a 20% gap between buyer and seller. And so how do you achieve the gap? Well, one way to do it is, as seller, you just accept a lower price. The issue here is a lot of private equity firms have marked their portfolios at very significant levels, and taking that mark down and realizing a lower price below that mark, it's a challenge. You've been telling your investors what the asset is worth, and you can't achieve that valuation. That's very challenging, frustrating, so on and so forth. One way to solve this problem is to have the portfolio company grow into that valuation. And I do think a lot of private equity firms have been waiting for that. Some will actually achieve that growth and be able to transact, and we expect that to kick up activity. However, many will not. And so I don't actually think that and don't expect that M&A volume will rebound entirely overnight. But I do think we're at very depressed and low levels, and you will start to see significantly more activity than we have recently.
So yeah, benefit of time plus obviously the rate cut making that bid-ask valuation spread not quite as problematic. When we're talking about trends, Vikas, the other thing we've seen is private credit deals continuing to get larger and larger. You know, yes. There's deals getting done in the multi-billions that even 5 years ago, you couldn't have said that. 2 years ago, you could barely say that with a straight face. Do you expect that to continue?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite charts to look at is the S&P Leveraged Loan Index, the price action. If you look at it over the last 20 plus years, what I find astounding, and I think you would find astounding, is the volatility. You know, we're talking about very large companies and the loans, not the equity of those businesses. And the amount of volatility that has existed is really a function of the change in our banking system. Post 08, 09, you've got banks being forced to hold less assets given regulation. And as a result of that, you create more market volatility in where these loans get executed and traded without the banks there to hold them as a buffer. And so, you know, when you sort of boil it all down, I think borrowers are sitting there and saying, we will pay more for private credit, but it is certain, it is quick, and I know my lender. I don't have to talk to 50 plus lenders to get something done. I can call up one, two, or a few. And I think that will continue to grow the market. We're at $1.7 trillion in size now, compounding at 10, 15% plus a year. I think that continues. And the capital is there and available for it. So I do expect it to continue.
One last theme on private credit. You've seen an increasing number of deals in the private credit market employ PIK interest, at least for some portion of their spread in the current environment. Talk to me a little bit about the drivers behind that and whether you expect that to continue in the coming years.
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic and very timely. I think there is really two versions of PIK. One, quite acceptable, the other somewhat worrying. And I'll walk through both. In terms of the acceptable version, yes, you're right. With rates as high as they are, if a company needs some flexibility, whether it's for a short period of time to operate and actually invest in their business, you may offer some PIK flexibility. It is something the public markets don't do or don't do well, I should say. And as a result, borrowers do value it in the private markets, make use of it, and it is very constructive in allowing for a borrower to pursue their business plan, whatever it may be. We do that. We do it on occasion. We'll pick a very small portion of the spread, and we'll keep the time horizon quite limited, let's say 12, 18 months, and also charge a premium for it. That version of PIK, we think, is very attractive way to win transactions and quite helpful to grow the portfolio with very nice, high-quality assets.
And before we move off that, we always say, like, you got to earn your right to have PIK interest. And these are earned scenarios where it actually deserves it and it makes sense for both sides.
You said it well.
Yeah. Where's the problem?
The problem is the inverse, which is you didn't underwrite that loan to have PIK. You experience some stress down the line, say 3-4 years, or you're near maturity and there's a problem refinancing your loan. So you offer the borrower PIK. Growing up in credit, I always thought you can't pay interest or you can't pay principal and maturity. That's a default. If you take this construct to the extreme and you PIK all interest and push out maturities, you may never have to report a default.
You and I are dating ourselves that I'm nodding vigorously
bit,
at
yeah,
this.
Yeah. Yes. You a little bit more than me, but.
How dare you.
This is a real issue.
Yeah.
And if you see some of the press around portfolios having an increasing number of fully picked assets, what they're really doing is hiding defaults.
Yeah. I had an investor meeting this morning and somebody asked me a question about percentage of pick in the portfolio. And I made the same point. You need to say it's not what the percentage is pick, how many started there. Ending up there is a very different set of circumstances. That makes total sense. Scott, I want to talk a little bit about the overall health and the trade-off between the public and private markets. They're not always directly competitive, though, as Vikas said correctly, you know, if you've got time and it's an easier story, of course, it's a better execution. What are you seeing in terms of the pass back and forth between public and private? There are points, you know, 18 months ago where private deals were taking every public deal normal execution because the markets were closed. That's obviously changed greatly in the last year. You know, what are you seeing in terms of the public versus private executions?
Yeah, I think coming off of that period of time where it was clear that the public markets, it was a struggle to get things done. And for obvious reasons, as Vikas mentioned, we go to heavily correlated moves in price and a lot of volatility pretty quickly, right? And that can really be tough for borrowers. And it's great that private credit is there as now another option. I would say coming off of that, with the kind of rebound in the markets, obviously syndicated lenders are feeling better about the world. I'd say we've reached a better state of equilibrium. And look, at HPS, we have the benefit without having a restrictive wall of understanding a loan that might live in, you know, a contemplated private world for a minute, and then ultimately end up in the syndicated markets, we kind of get to see that life cycle. And it's becoming pretty quick. The decision amongst borrowers, they're getting very, I'd say, efficient and sophisticated in terms of recognizing, you know, where the value is for them and pivoting back and forth. But that's not to say they're necessarily playing one off the other to the detriment of one of the markets. I think private credit is doing the right thing in the sense that it's providing a very viable option and not egregiously expensive. There is obviously a premium on a private credit deal. But if a borrower wants to pivot, we're seeing that happen over the course of, let's say, weeks or maybe a month, month and a half, probably more than we would definitely in the environment you were referencing. And so I think the markets are essentially helping borrowers price risk, which I don't think is unhealthy for any market. Anytime there are checkpoints and ways for everyone to understand where risk is going to clear, and it does so efficiently relative to the desire of both buyer and seller, I think we're in a pretty healthy place right now.
And because from your side of the house, as Scott correctly pointed out, we're at, you know, historic tights on the public side. What impact does that have on the private credit side of HPS?
When you have frothy and well-performing public markets, you should expect to see less volume on the private side. I do think, though, you still have this idea that private credit provides speed and certainty in rapidly changing environments. We have geopolitical issues around the world. We have trade issues, strikes, port implications, so on and so forth. So there's a lot to worry about. And I think borrowers, despite, you know, a very healthy public market, still value sort of that alternative. And I think that is a way to describe the market as bounced.
Well, and I might add to that too, you know, a clean and simple story that in a 45-minute meeting you can explain why it's a good credit, that always will favor a public execution. You input any kind of complexity, it's a corporate carve-out, it's a merger, something that requires more work, even in a robust environment, you know, the private markets can often prevail. Well, let's move then to the last set of thoughts here. Scott, I want to move back to you. You know, let's put our crystal ball hat on for a second. Given the environment we're in and given some of the puts and takes that you guys have addressed, are there themes or subsectors when you look at 2025 and beyond that gets you excited from the public credit side of the house?
First, on a market theme, I personally love underwriting bond risk that has some sort of, you know, where you can buy high quality credit with some convexity that can move prices higher, because I think that's generally misunderstood by the investing community, fixed price convexity in the credit markets, right?
And you can have 15 years of zero interest rates, so nobody got to see any of that.
And you can have, you know, you can have triple B borrowers whose bonds trade at 120 cents on the dollar, and you can get real double digit returns if you're able to kind of identify the right time period and opportunity set. You know, everybody talks about maturity walls and the like, and if you look at 2025 and 2026, the one thing that sticks out to us is that there's about $200 billion of bond maturities coming in those 2 year categories. And like I said earlier, CFOs and treasurers have been very, very reluctant to proactively refinance because their stated rate, their stated coupons have been so low for so long. So we've got about, you know, 10, 11% of the market maturing in those 2 years. Historical norms are something more like 6 to 7%. So that's a bit of a bubble in terms of what needs to come to market. Inherently, these are higher quality issuers, because if you go back to when these bonds were issued, it would have been during COVID. And who had access to the unsecured markets during COVID? It was only the companies that historically could access the debt and equity markets and had the ability to sustain tough economic environments. And so we think there is a, you know, I won't say a swell, but at least an increasing flow of high quality credit that's going to come to the market with some duration and price convexity to the upside. So we think bonds will have their moment. sometime 2025, 2026, and we want to be ready for that. So that's a big market theme that we're focused on. As far as, you know, our portfolios, our borrowers, you know, we try to stay close to a lot of kind of tenants from an underwriting perspective, which are, we avoid a lot of cyclicality, we avoid a lot of commodity risk. We like leverageable, you know, cash flow models, you know, service industries, brokerage, financial services, business services, healthcare technology, things like that. And then obviously software is a huge component of our market. And so what we've really tried to identify is on the solution and, you know, kind of product level, AI, things like that, who's integrating that the best, who stands to be a winner versus a, you know, somebody who's displaced. And look, I think much like HPS is across the board, we want to focus on our underwriting and always try to outperform on credit selection. We'll get some market moves right, but if we outperform on credit selection, we think we're going to be okay. And that's what we're working on.
All right, Vikas, then same for you. What are themes or subsectors you get excited about?
I'll add on to what, Scott, you identified. I think AI is something we're all talking about. The infrastructure that's required to get AI to where it's headed is something to think about. It will be disruptive for a number of industries. It will be productive for a number of industries. We think about that. There's sort of less obvious sectoral shifts, one being GLP-1 drugs, how they're impacting consumption, retail, and rapidly changing consumer preferences. Putting it all together, though, one thing I would highlight as to how we think about portfolio construction in a very unique way, we like sector diversification. You know, when you look at private credit writ large, a lot of our peers, because they're very focused on LBO lending very specifically, have no choice but to be overweight software and healthcare. And you'll see a lot of portfolios 30 to 50% allocated to software, 20, 30% healthcare, pretty standard in private credit land. We've taken a very different approach and decided that while I can share some thoughts on AI and GLP-1 and other sectoral perspectives, the better approach from a pure credit perspective is sectoral diversification. Keep it extremely diverse, really a lesson we learned from COVID and are implementing pretty regularly.
Makes total sense. Thank you, Vikas and Scott, for all your insights, and thank you for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investor Partner. Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.
This material was presented by HPS Investment Partners, LLC, for information purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast are that of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners. Nothing contained herein constitutes investment, legal, tax, or other advice, nor is it to be relied on in making an investment or other decision. HPS makes no representation or warranty, expressed or implied, with respect to the information contained herein, including, without limitation, information obtained from third parties, and expressly disclaims any and all liability based on or relating to the information contained in or errors or omissions, negligent or otherwise, from these materials, or based on or relating to the recipient's use or the use by any of its affiliates or representatives of these materials. This material may contain forward-looking statements. These are based upon a number of assumptions concerning future conditions that ultimately may prove to be inaccurate. Such forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties and may be affected by various factors that may cause actual results to differ materially from those in the forward-looking statements. Any forward-looking statements speak only as of the date they are made, and HPS assumes no duty to and does not undertake to update forward-looking statements or any other information contained herein.